Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go.
Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we have narrated history episodes, and we also have episodes where we sit down with filmmakers, authors, politicians, and historians to talk about wars in history. Today's guest I'm very excited about is Agent Leon Carroll Jr. He is a former Marine Corps officer, a longtime NCIS special agent who was also the technical advisor to the hit TV show NCIS. And he held that role for over 20 seasons, which is pretty impressive. Today, he's going to discuss his book, which he co-authored with actor Mark Harmon, Ghosts of Honolulu, a Japanese spy, a Japanese-American spy hunter, and the untold story of Pearl Harbor. Leon, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you, Emily, and thank you for having me.
Yes. So, this is really interesting. I love talking about World War II. As we were kind of discussing a little before we recorded here, we don't want to forget what happened and we don't want to forget the people involved. So your book is about Hawaii during World War II and some of the incredible real life characters, most notably Douglas Fada. Can you kind of just give us an overview of who he was, what the heck he was doing in Hawaii during World War II?
Well, he was from Hawaii, so that was a good reason to be there. But I tell you, he was a Nisei, and his parents had immigrated from Japan, and he grew up there from a very young age. Actually, he was born there, and went to high school there, and went to college. Actually, left his parents sent him to Japan to kind of get a little sense of the culture, which is really what helped him later on in getting a job with ONI. But he came back and finished his collegiate education at the University of Hawaii. And he was kind of like your all-American kid because he was a scout. He was involved in baseball, was his passion. He was very good at it, by the way. And that led to some other things we can talk about later, present-day things that have happened with me and Japanese-American baseball. But he was
I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, he was just the all-American kid who had an opportunity to help this country in World War II. He started very early before the war started in 1939, and he stayed on with our organization. When he started, we were Office of Naval Intelligence, and when he left, we were called the Naval Investigative Service at that time. So he went from 1939 to 1975, operating in different categories of things that we do in terms of investigations.
That is so fascinating how the organization evolved over time. I'm sure we could do like a whole series about that in and of itself.
Oh. Yes. And that's kind of how we started looking at this project, not just this one, but the whole series of ghost stories that we can tell. So
that's what I was curious about, like how this kind of started out of all these stories. This is a really fascinating story, but how did you stumble on this, or did you always kind of know about him?
No, I didn't know anything about him. Mm-hmm. And just to give you a little background real quick, when we worked on the show, myself and Mark, we'd sit next to each other all the time, and I'm there to make sure that things are real, right? Mm-hmm. And after about 4 seasons, I would say, he would turn to me, says, Leon, would you guys do this? And most of the time I'm saying no, but we're doing a documentary. You don't want to see, you know, someone sitting at a desk writing paperwork for 3 hours. So long story short, he said, well, one day if we get a chance to tell real stories about real people, then we're going to do it. So 15, 16 years later, actually, he had left the show when this had happened. I was still working on it. And he called me and he says, hey, Leon, you know what we've been talking about for all this time? And I go, Mark, we've been sitting next to each other, having lunch every day for 19 years. What are you talking about? We've had a lot of things that we discussed. And he says, no, you know, it's about telling the stories of real people, real agents doing things.
Really?
And I go, wow. I said, well, right off the bat, I said, sign me up. Yeah. So he had an opportunity that was presented to him to do a book, and he could have done it on anything. Probably what they were looking for is more of a show and tell thing for the show. But he came back and told them, he says, the only book I want to do is a book about the real agency and one that includes the help of Leon Carroll.
So fantastic.
It was. And we had together and had a meeting with an agent and the publisher. And how this particular book was selected, they asked me if I could come up with 5 ideas. And this was one of the 5 ideas. Initially, we were going to look at the history of ONI, which began in 1882.
We
went back and looked at what's called the NCISA History Project, which I'll talk a little bit about more later, but it goes back to 1882. But as you might imagine, the records that were kept from back then weren't the best.
So good.
And they weren't necessarily, one, they were very secretive, much more so than what you see in our intelligence community today. Very close-lit. So what happened was we went from basically 1882 to a story that we thought would work to tell kind of the transition of the agency. And lo and behold, that's how I came across Doug Wanner. So in doing so, I had the guys who actually did put together this history project years ago. You're still working on it. I said, hey, what do you guys know about Doug Wanner? Well, we know a lot about Doug Wanner because we've been researching him for 20 years.
Wow.
And we've been trying to figure out how to get his story told. And I said, guess what, guys? I think they're going to want to do this story. So that's basically how it started.
That's really cool. All these like winding roads that had to kind of coalesce for this story to come out. I wanted to ask, okay, so Doug Wanner, was his identity as a Japanese American, did that affect the kind of work that he was not allowed to do or allowed to do?
Actually, he was vetted real well at an early age, actually while he was in college. And I think the fact that he had gone back and studied in Japan after he graduated from high school, he actually lived in Japan for like 3 or 4 years. His family did that. And I think anytime that happens, the intelligence agencies on the other side are going to say, oh, what about this guy? Is he one of us or is he one of them? And that's the dilemma that Wanda had to live through pretty much his whole life, actually, but certainly during World War II. And he was very aware of that. So when he was vetted in 1939, it was kind of a clandestine type of thing. He didn't realize, it wasn't like he went in and applied for a job. He basically was getting ready to graduate. He was in a class that was an optional for him because it was a Japanese language class, which he already spoke. And actually the professor says, if I don't show up one day, then Doug can teach the class. But one of the things I think that was unique about this is that professor would always seat people alphabetically. And somehow he being Doug Wanner, was seated next to a guy whose last name began with an R, Kenneth Ringel. Kenneth Ringel was a naval intelligence officer. Kenneth Ringel vetted Doug Wanner during this period of time, actually had him over to his house, you know, showed him, introduced him to his family, et cetera, et cetera. The next thing Ken Ringel does is he talks to his boss in the district intelligence office and says, I think this guy is a guy we need to do translation, to do other things, which ended up being undercover work, is what we would call it in the criminal world. And that's pretty much how he came to light to us as ONI at that time.
That's almost ironically, it sounds like something a screenwriter would come up with. Like, oh, these guys just sit next to each other.
Do you know anybody who wants to produce the movie? Mark and I laugh about that all the time because both of us get asked that question. Of course, he's he's got more access to people that can come up with the funding for that than I do, for sure. But, you know, it is something that could be turned into a feature. And I think it would be a little bit costly, but I think it's something that bears taking a look at for sure.
Yeah. And in my experience, getting a feature produced is a lot easier than a TV series. So I think it could absolutely could be a feature. Okay. That would be I would watch that for sure. Great. Even after reading the book, I would watch that. Yeah. And so, okay, so you actually met with Doug Wada's family members. Is that, that's right?
That's an interesting story. Not in person. And the two guys that had put together all that information 20 some odd years ago, actually, yeah, 20 years ago this year, probably.
Oh, wow.
They had attempted to reach out to the family, and one of them talked to the grandson, who didn't seem to be interested in furthering that relationship, I guess. And they tried to reach him several times afterwards. When we picked up on it, when I say we, Mark, myself, and our whole team,
sure.
I tried to do it. And I knew that if I throw in Mark Harmon's name, I'd get a response. I never did it, right?
Oh.
So I had Doug Wada's daughter's information, but at that time I thought she was in her 90s and I wasn't going to cold call a 90-year-old woman. Yeah. So what happened was once we did our book tour and we had, you know, interviews done on local outlets all across the country, the Bay Area happened to have been one. So the day after that, we were in New York City and we were meeting our agent for lunch. And I see my cell phone rings and I see, oh, there's a Japanese surname. Now I'm like, who did I tick off yesterday in these 20 some odd interviews that I did, right? So I decided I'm going to pick it up. And it happened to be Doug Wada's grandson.
By the wall.
And I said, wow, I said, you've made this whole thing worthwhile. And he said, first, let me apologize for, you know, ghosting you guys. And he said, but I want to thank you for what you're doing for our grandfather. And I said, really? He goes, yeah. And he's telling me, you know, kind of about his mom. And it turns out she's not in her 90s. He lives with the mom. And she's in her 80s, I think, like mid-80s.
Wow.
And so he said, here's what happened, is one of my mom's friends is watching a local affiliate, and she saw that you guys are on. She calls my mom and says, hey, they're talking about your dad on television. So she watched it, and that's how that whole connection was made. So after that, we had a better connection. Turns out Doug Wada's grandson has a son that lives here in Pasadena, actually. And it's crazy how this has kind of evolved. But I said to him later when we were talking about this whole thing, because did your grandfather ever talk about this stuff? And he says, you know, he was a very quiet man. He didn't really talk about what he did, you know, and most of us who are grandkids didn't know that. My mom probably knew a little bit more than us, but he says, you know, when we'd have some of these family gatherings and he would start drinking bourbon, he would talk more about it. Mm. And if you notice in the book, there are a couple of occasions where he was out and he got drunk, right? And came back the next day for work. And, you know, he was getting grief about it because did you remember what you did last night? You know, Doug, you were with these guys. But anyway, the grandson then said, you've heard the term bourbon and water, right? Well, in our house, it was bourbon and water, because when he had the bourbon, he would talk about it. So that's kind of how it worked with the family. And actually, is when we were on a different, we did another tour after that, and we were gifted a bottle of bourbon.
No.
And Mark and I re-gifted it to the Wada family.
No. Yeah. Oh, that is just a treasure, that little story there. That is incredible. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. That kind of when I've interviewed people who do books or TV series on World War II, real life World War II vets, it's always this moment of meeting the guys who were actually there or the descendants that really just hits you hard and stays with you. And like you said, makes it worth doing, you know, so that is really a cool story. And okay, so hopping into Kauai a little bit at the time in World War II, can you describe what the atmosphere would have been like just a little before Pearl Harbor?
Hawaii was an interesting case, a really interesting story. And I would say that one of the things that our intelligence agencies, or our government more so than intelligence agencies, we really had a jaundiced view of the two generations of Japanese people that were there, the ones that immigrated, the Issei and the Nisei. And I think the feeling was that they would be loyal to the Imperial Japanese Army and military, right, and all of what was going on, which was couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah.
And I kind of see a little bit of that today. It's like the Nisei, they were kids, right? All they knew was Hawaii, and they grew up, and all they knew was being American. So their American sentiment was strong. They were very loyal. And only a few Issei, which we find in our book, actually were even involved in providing any information to the Japanese.
Right.
So they were here to do the business. You know, they were brought to Hawaii to work on plantations. And that's essentially what they did. Doug Wada's dad was a Shinto carpenter. He built Shinto shrines. And they were just everyday, hardworking people that really didn't have a big clue about what was going on from a political, geopolitical standpoint in Japan. And at that time, as you well know, we didn't have the internet and social media and all of that stuff. So people were just wanting to live their lives, but they were very loyal.
And what was that? There was that spy that was like, is Japanese spy in Hawaii. And he was like, well, I can't trust the Japanese here because they're way too loyal to America. He tells a little about that.
Yes, Yoshikawa.
Yes,
and,
yes.
He's an interesting story as well. He was a military officer in Japan, went through flight training and didn't do very well as an officer. So they put him in Japanese naval intelligence.
Cool.
And he worked at a high level staff, and they found that maybe he would be better as a diplomat. So they sent him to Hawaii as a deputy consul general. And he was pretty much under a cover. He took on a different name, a pseudonym name. And his job was really to go out and recruit spies for Japan. And one of the things, and this was, I think, a good spot, you know, the hierarchy of the Japanese American people in Japan, they belong to a lot of different social clubs, which was a thing for pretty much all cultures back then. And the thought was that, one, the Japanese would, you know, really infiltrate there. And it turned out it was just limited involvement. And as you read in the book, it ended up being very few of them really had any allegiance to Japan and joined the American U.S. military.
So I love all of the, I'm one of those people, I'm sure it's like almost everybody loves spy craft and the trade craft of, you know, intelligence and espionage. It's very fascinating. And I didn't know a lot about what was going on in Hawaii before I read the book and started, like, you know, then maybe I'd be like, oh, what's that? And I'd like Google it a little bit and I'd go down this rabbit hole. So very fascinating. Can you tell us about, so there was the first American POW, or the first POW in World War II that America had captured, and Wada was involved in the interrogation.
That's accurate. And that's moving far down the line of, you know, what caused the war, but it was pretty interesting. It allows me to give you this information about Doug Wada as well. So he had done some low-level undercover type stuff before all of this happened. you know, being a shore patrol officer. He worked as a journalist, looking at stories for a Japanese paper. And so he had this background that he had on the job training, so to speak. And he met a individual, and here's another interesting point. So in World War II, the Navy did not allow Japanese Americans, even before the war started, to be in the United States Navy active duty. So Wada was a civilian up until pretty much the war's end. And the person behind that was the Secretary of the Navy by the name of Frank Knox, who, you know, until he passed away, there were no active duty Navy, Japanese Navy personnel. The Army, on the other hand, was just the opposite. They had an individual by the name of Hiro Iwai, who came on in 1931 in Army Military Intelligence. Later, he and Wada became partners in doing all types of things. I'll say undercover because people understand that. Undercover, yeah. During the early late 30s, I should say, and up to World War I, to Pearl Harbor. So what happened that day, and I don't want to give away too much of the book in case somebody wants to go buy it, but we did a kind of a Hollywood thing, and we did like a teaser cold open first. That was one of the things we changed from our first draft to where we started on December 7th, and Wada's doing what Wada does on a Sunday. And then we go into his childhood all the way up through college and then what we're getting to right now. So on that particular day, Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941, they had many subs, they being the Japanese, that were going along the coastline of Hawaii. And one of them basically beached. Mm. And they were found by some folks on the beach, and the military got called. And they brought this guy in. Only one of the two people in the crew survived. One of them was the commander of the captain of the sub. And they brought him in, and they brought in Wada and Iwai to do the interrogation because they spoke Japanese. And by that time, well, Iwai had been very experienced by that time. But so now you have the other counterintelligence guys, FBI, ONI, and they're kind of playing a peripheral role. But one of the things that this individual wanted to do is, you know, the Japanese are very proud people, and he felt that he had failed in his mission. And he asked them if he could commit suicide. And Wada and Iwai, using interrogation techniques that I learned, you know, 40 years later or whatever, to kind of talk him out of it, make him feel good, better about, you know, failing, if you might put it that way, and getting as much information as they can. Well, that guy lived until the 70s, I believe it was, and he was a corporate exec in a Latin American country for Honda, I believe it was.
That's so random.
So it's kind of interesting. That particular day, and they were the first to have been captured, you know, in the Pacific for sure. Well, probably anywhere, because that was the day the war started for us.
Right, like right into it. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, here we have the first Japanese-American ONI agent at that time, now would be NCIS, basically doing the first interrogation of World War II for the United States.
So and because he sat next to this guy in class like this.
That was a complete setup, by the way. Well, it wasn't that Wada was in the class, because he wanted to do that to get an easy credit, to be honest.
Yeah, sure.
And but the individual, Ken Ringel, who was a lieutenant commander at the time, was in the class to do exactly that, people who were in that class that he could use as assets.
I love it. I'd like to hear his story and how he got there. That's really interesting, all these threads.
Right.
Okay, so tell me about the baseball stuff. I am so curious. It's like a lost story here.
Well, it's really one that it just amazed me because, you know, I grew up loving baseball. Mm. That was my first love. And of course, at that time, there were no Japanese players in Major League Baseball. Going back into the 30s and 40s, they had leagues in Japan, and they played it in Hawaii as well. And actually, Doug Wada went to Japan with a team, and they played in Japan. And he was a second baseman. I think he called him Chick Wada. And so
crazy.
And what would happen is American baseball players like Ty Cobb would go to Japan and do exhibition games. So they would play against these really good Japanese players. So fast forward to my time with Sadahara Oh, who was a star in Japan, really didn't get a chance to play here. Then you had Ichiro came to Seattle when I lived up there. And he was probably the first star. Now you look at Major League Baseball and the Dodgers. I mean, I went to a game 2 weeks ago, and the Japanese influence is awesome. It's great. A lot of the fans are flying in from Japan to watch the Dodgers, who have, I think, two Japanese Americans and one Korean playing. But the other part of this story for me personally is that a friend of mine who manages a Paul Park up here called me, and she says, "Have you ever heard of the Gardena Rebels?" And I said, "No, but I know that there's a Japanese league here in California, and I know they're a minor league and et cetera, et cetera." She says, "Well, they play their games here, and I'd like for you to come up and meet them. This is about the book." So sent her a book, and she gave it to the captain of the team, who then shared it with his teammates, and he invited me up for a game. And he says, "You know, we really appreciate this. This is stuff we never knew, because in our paperback," which is, by the way, on the bestseller list, well, both of them were, but paperback is doing lights out, maybe because it has more pictures, and it has pictures of Doug Wada and his baseball teams. So they have an event that they do at the internment camp up in Central California every year, and it's when they bring the Japanese League teams in and they have a tournament. And I was invited to attend that, but I couldn't make it because of a scheduling conflict this past year. But if I get invited again, I'm going to try to make it for sure. But
putting it out there, invite him again.
It's amazing that a book would create that type of interest. And I have to say myself, I can't speak for Mark, but I was kind of concerned about how Japanese Americans would look at the book. Because even Doug Wada was worried, not about the book, but about how his own people felt about him, whose mission really was from the American government, was to spy on them.
Yeah.
You know, they put together some of the lists. They were called pickup lists. So before the war really got hot, there was indications that this was going to happen. They just didn't know when or where. And obviously we were surprised. But the FBI, working with all the other military intelligence agencies, were coordinating the names of people that people like Doug Wada would provide for a list. So when Pearl Harbor happened, they could go out and pick up these people, which did happen, by the way. But it turned out very few compared to what happened here in internment here in California. But that's kind of the story of him and baseball. And, you know, he talked about it quite a bit in interviews that he did as well.
That is so fascinating. Baseball's so American. And this is like just feels like one of those incredible, almost lost stories, you know, where it's hard to imagine all of this stuff happening with somebody who's so important to our nation's history. And like, it just gone in the wind, you know, and that I hate that. I wanted to ask you, this is one of my favorite questions, asking people about their sources and the difficulties and finding sources for the book. Were some things still like super redacted, and it was just like.
Well, Emily, this was a case that where we had time was on our side in one way, in terms of documentation, because most classified documents are declassified after about 25 years.
Yes.
And I do have, I got boxes of stuff over here. I can't get back to these guys, but that were confidential, but then declassified. So yeah, I do have some documents that had been classified, but they're all declassified now. And that was kind of a good thing. The bad thing was, unlike our second book, where we were able to talk to everybody involved,
right?
Nobody knew who WADA was. Well, let me back up. A few people alive knew who he was. Mm-hmm. Even some said, I saw him, but I didn't know what he was doing. I didn't know what he was doing. So, interesting story. A friend of mine who is turning 100, I believe now, probably one of the oldest retired NCIS agents, or he was long gone when he became NCIS, but NIS agents. And his name was Roy Mosteller. And I said, Roy, did you know Doug WADA? Because Roy had started working. Mm-hmm. He wasn't with ONI. Well, he was with ONI, but not as an agent. He was an admin person back in the 40s during World War II. And he was assigned to Hawaii. And I said, did you know Doug WADA? He goes, you know, Leon, he goes, I know that name. He goes, I know the guy. But I can't recall ever talking to him or meeting him. But he was there when I was there. And I said, wow, that's interesting. So lo and behold, back in those days, you didn't get the training, your training right away. So I think the first big training class they had was in 1952 or 54. And I'm looking at the picture. Now, WADA was like 5'2", no more than 5'4". Roy Mosteller is like, even at 100, he's over 6 feet tall. So I'm looking at the picture, and there's Doug WADA amongst 50 white guys, one Japanese guy, and all the others are white male.
Yeah.
He's at the front, and he's standing, so you could tell he's short. Back in the back is Roy Mosteller. And I says,
wow.
Roy, he was in your basic class. He goes, wow. He goes, I just don't remember. And I was doing another interview at the Retirees Association banquet. And afterwards, one of the guys who I had worked under, who had long retired, but he says, hey, I worked with Doug WADA, and I know he was an agent because I saw he had credentials, but we never saw him in the office. Mm-hmm. And I go, wow, he was really doing the cover thing, right?
Did his job very well. Yeah.
Yes.
That is incredible. That must have been, I would imagine if I were 100 years old and somebody's like, here's this picture of you and this other guy, like my mind would just be blown, totally blown. That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
What kind of ideas are you hoping that readers walk away with after reading the book, or feelings that they walk away with?
Well, I would say first that our goal was to tell stories of little or unknown individuals, but who were involved in big events. And I think that's the key here with WADA. Not even people that were in our organization really knew that much about him. They knew of him, but they didn't know what he did. Mm-hmm. And actually, they've fallen short on recognizing him before this book, to be honest with you, or before these guys. And this book allowed the two guys who actually had done original research on him, it allowed them to come out and tell a story. So 2 years ago, I believe it was, for Asian American and Pacific Islander Month, they went back and they told the story of Doug WADA. And since then, there's been much more interest because now we have high-level people at our executive level that are Japanese Americans. So it takes that kind of influence to get things done, and they are going to do a monument for him at Pearl Harbor, to be honest with you.
Wow.
And hopefully, it may have already happened this last December, but I'm hoping it, because I'd like to be there for that. WADA and his wife both are buried in the punch bowl, and my neighbor was over there, and they didn't know, I don't even think they read the book, but they knew I was doing a book about it. And they took pictures of the gravesite and they go, is this the Doug Wada you were writing about? God. And I go, well, unless there's another one, Doug and Helen Wada buried in the punch bowl, that's got to be them, right?
Wow.
So, small world.
Yes, that is incredible. Well, I highly, highly recommend this book to anybody interested in World War II, especially the Pacific and Japanese Americans and anything like that in World War II. Thank you so, so much for coming on the show and answering all of these questions. I don't want to give away too much about the book, you know, because I do think people would be very interested in the stuff that they find in the book. And before I go, I just wanted to ask, you do have Ghosts of Panama out right now. Are you, you said you're doing some, is there, what's the next one coming out? Can you tell me?
Is there a secret? We're going back to World War II.
Ooh. That's
as much as I can say at this point. And it's going to be good. It's been talked about before. But I'm not sure it's been talked about from the O&I perspective. So it'll be good. I think the people who are World War II buffs will either like it or they'll tear us apart.
Well, if it's anything like this one, I'm sure we're all going to love it. I'm very excited that you're going to go back to World War II. That's really cool. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Again, Leon Carroll Jr., co-author of Ghosts of Honolulu, A Japanese Spy, A Japanese-American Spy Hunter, and The Untold Story of Pearl Harbor. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Emily.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yes, you're welcome.